The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 31st of March, 2020. On the podcast today, I have Chris Jeffries, CEO of Dev Clever Holdings, and Chris discusses their response to government advice on COVID-19 and provide an update on current trading. Also on the podcast, Stephen Blythe, CEO of Expediator, XPD. Stephen also provides a business update in relation to COVID-19. Plus, I have Majid Shafiq, CEO, and Graham Heath, CFO of i3 Energy, who talk about their strategic production acquisition and TSX listing. And as it's a Tuesday, I have Glenn Goodman, former ITV business news correspondent and now the author of The Crypto Trader, discusses his views on the market and Bitcoin. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see both these lists, top 10 versions of both these lists, at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to keep up to date with all the companies in your portfolio? On the free Vox Markets app, you can create multiple watch lists and get instant news alerts about any company you follow. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Jeffries, CEO of Dev Clever Holdings, DEV, ticker there. Chris, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Justin. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. And we're in bizarre times. And of course, companies are coming up with updates on how COVID-19 is affecting them. You've done that, and we'll dig into that in a bit. But like I say, but generally, Chris, are you carrying on as normal at the moment, or as normal as you can be? Are you working remotely quite seamlessly?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, obviously in times of crisis such as this, you know, our people and customers' safety are paramount.
Yeah.
And I'm delighted really with the whole team's response to COVID-19 and the fact that the teams are now successfully implemented our remote working contingency plans, and all the teams continue to operate, you know, fairly normally, well, certainly as possible under these circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what direction, you know, is the business sort of going in here at the moment?
So the company announced a kind of refocus since our year end, with the primary objective being education as a platform, split between our revolutionary career guidance and recruitment platforms, LaunchYourCareer.com and Victor VR, although we do continue to service our blue chip agency clients as well. But in terms of direction, kind of moving forward, the business keenly focused on that edtech sector, which we believe has significant and immediate opportunities for the company. Some of these actually have been identified in the research note, which has been published on Vox today, which highlights the edtech markets and its predicted growth to be worth $252 billion just this year.
Wow. And so how does this relate to Dev Clever's tech then?
Well, I certainly feel that Dev Clever's proprietary SaaS tech or products are very well positioned to impact the market. We believe that just the UK, US and Canada, in terms of total serviceable market, would be worth over $1 billion in potential revenue per annum to the company.
Yeah, and you recently announced the company is launching with Lenovo in the US from April?
Yeah, well, with the US being the largest opportunity for our products and for the edtech sector, and the fact that we've secured a strategic route to market from April with the world's largest technology provider to the global education sector, Lenovo, we're anticipating a really accelerated growth now in, you know, what we are determining as a transformational year for Dev Clever.
Yeah. And so why do you believe then, Chris, that, you know, a tech giant like Lenovo, you know, is partnering with your products?
Well, VR in education is set to explode this year, or certainly the opinion that VR in education is set to explode. With all the major manufacturers as well, they're all trying to position their technology and secure their share of the market with lower value remote client devices, standalone devices, which don't necessarily be required to be connected to computers, and they're very mobile and versatile. And Victor VR and LaunchYourCareer.com is really a pivotal application, as we describe it to, in that sector. And that is that in terms of schools looking to embrace virtual reality, there's quite a lot of barriers in place, because you've got to think about the people who have to use it. So staff, for example, you know, you can imagine wheeling out a trolley full of virtual reality headsets and a management platform and expecting teachers to instantly know what it's all about. So Victor VR is a fantastic way to softly introduce the technology into schools, because it's very intuitive, it's almost plug and play, and it requires very little training and onboarding. So it's a fantastic way for schools to embrace and adopt VR without having to worry about the impact on staff, training, students and take up. And it's very light touch. In addition to that as well, it only requires the school to invest in just one headset as a minimum. It works on multiple devices within a classroom, but you only actually need one headset, because it's part of a career, embedded careers program. So it means, from a training point of view, and the investment is a much faster decision for schools to make. And also, because it's career focused, which is a global focus for all the education sector around the world, it offers immediate benefits and return on that investment in virtual reality for schools, whereas a lot of other content out there is very much investment for the future. Victor is very much return on that investment today. And the reason we've been working in partnership with, you know, we wanted to find the right hardware manufacturer who was committed to the education sector and had the footprint to scale globally with us with this technology. And that's because what we wanted to do is make sure that when schools invest in the technology, it's a scalable solution. So they're not buying headsets and then they have to buy different headsets in order to do other functions to do with curriculum learning. Victor is a scalable asset. So you buy one headset or more than one headset, and then as your demands internally increase within the school for virtual reality learning, you build on top of the platform, which means that essentially, whichever headset that a school chooses to buy first, with Victor on top of it, it's likely there'll be more of the same headsets purchased, which is, you know, a great partnership for a software SaaS company like ourselves, and then also a hardware manufacturer who's looking to increase their footprint in that particular market share within VR, because it's a low cost entry point for a school, and it kind of ensures that they'll continue to buy that same hardware leading forward. In addition to that as well, Victor and LaunchYourCareer.com, the analytics side of it actually assesses all the students inside the school, not just about career guidance, but it also identifies what subjects or sectors they're likely to work in the future. So the school can then use it as an assessment tool to understand what their future needs are for VR in terms of content and the amount of headsets, based on the volume of students who are looking to potentially go on to do jobs in each individual sector. So it's almost an assessment of what your virtual reality requirements are, and which is why, you know, it's so pertinent in the market at this particular time, because it's the ideal experience to get that global traction from schools.
Yeah, and you mentioned there about sort of remote learning solution was coming to market soon.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I mean, every company is being dynamic given the current circumstances. Now, we launched a platform which was called Launchpad for Employers last year, and it's, you know, it's already being used very successfully by national retailers in the UK and the US. And the platform itself, Launchpad for Employers, was developed as an extension to Launch Your Career. So, kind of once school children have left school and gone through education and they're starting their career, it's a remote based learning and training solution which allows companies to induct young people into new employment roles, and it's also a mechanism to help large organizations upskill their existing workforce into new positions as things like automation takes effect and effects and redundancies in certain trades become more visible. And what we're doing is, because essentially it is a modern remote-based learning solution accessible from any device, mobiles, tablets, even in VR. What we are now doing is talking to some of our existing customers in terms of academies and groups and school groups about very rapidly repurposing that to provide them with the support that they need to deliver remote-based teaching and learning for schools and school children. So, and again, because the platform's already developed, we anticipate we can have that up and running by middle of April. So we're working hard in the background to get that up and running so we can support students, teachers and parents as well.
Yeah. And what about agency services there?
So, I mean, it was also important for us when we announced our year end that what we didn't want to do, although we wanted to very firmly put our foot forward to say that we are, you know, super focused on the education products in the education sector, we can't forget about our agency services, because we have some fantastic technology and we also work with a fantastic range of blue chip customers internationally. You know, people are the likes of Toshiba, Pepsi Max, Britvic, Heineken and many others, household names. So with the recent acquisition of Phoenix Digital, which we again recently announced, that's given us the capability to still have dedicated resource on this channel. And with the kind of onboarding and integration of them teams now, I know we have seen an impressive uplift in our sales conversions already through some of their more consumer activations.
Lovely stuff. Okay, Chris, as always, three reasons then why someone should hit that follow button and add you to their watch list, please.
Absolutely. So we have proprietary technology that is offered to customers globally on a SaaS basis in the education sector. We've partnered with the number one supplier of technology to the global edtech sector, Lenovo. And our rollout starts from the 1st of April in the US, the largest edtech market in the world. And there's more information about the size of the market within the new research note, which has just been published by Vox. And it's accessible on the devcleverholdingsplc.com website.
Marvellous stuff, Chris. Good to chat to you and hopefully be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Wonderful. Thanks, Justin. Thanks for your time. Stay safe.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Stephen Blythe, Chief Executive Officer of Expediator. XPD is ticker there. Stephen, thanks for joining me.
Yes, good morning.
Yeah, it's good to get a COVID-19 update from you today because, of course, things are changing so quickly at the moment. Everyone's affected by this, and so it's nice to get that, and we'll dig into that. But as always, Stephen, there's people listening, I assume, who are not familiar maybe with Expediator. So just give them a brief summary as to what the business is about, please.
Well, very relevant to the situation at the moment is we are an asset-light freight management business. And our main activity is moving freight internationally, very strong into Eastern Europe areas in particular. And over the last few years since we've been listed, we've expanded our activities for air and sea activity. So we cover Southampton, Felixstowe, Dover, Heathrow, etc. That's our main division, freight forwarding. We also have logistics, which is all about warehousing. And in that division, in Romania, we have our Palex entity, which I'll talk about in a minute, which is performing very well, which is a palletized freight network, the only one in Romania. Mm-hmm. And another big division that we have is our affinity division, which has 2,000 truckers running 14,000, 15,000 vehicles across Europe, where we supply them with services. So we buy bulk and we sell on, we make margin. That's the business in general.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Okay, so you've broken down the RNS today into three areas. So let's just start, first of all, with a trading update, if you could. How is trading, Alison?
Well, to be honest, up until the end of March, we are overall in line with where we expect to be. Mm-hmm. There are some divisions which are performing better. One of those, which I just alluded to, our Palex operation in Romania. And I had the figures come through this morning. And it looks as if we're going to be pretty much at the highest point we've ever been. And certainly in the first 3 months, that division is 20% plus up on the previous year. Mm-hmm. So activity is holding up there quite well. We have the other side and flip coin to that one is in the UK, one of our divisions, which deals principally with retailers on the high street. Well, as we know, they're all closed. Mm-hmm. So that's the opposite end of the spectrum. So we've got some good pockets of activity. freight forwarding in Romania. We're strong in Lithuania, Romania, Bulgaria. They are obviously catching this problem a little bit later. And activity in Europe has been holding up. There's been issues in terms of getting supply of trucks. So international drivers don't particularly want to be traveling across borders at this moment, and we understand that. So the laws of supply and demand will kick in, and therefore having the ability to source trucks is a very important aspect. Because if you you can't source the trucks, you can't do the jobs for your customers. Hmm. And so freight rates are going up, but we're able to pass that on to customers. And whilst activity in the last month has been lower on a turnover line, I'm pleased to say that margins are holding up reasonably well across areas. But because we are able to flex our activity, we will scale down where we need to. The good thing for us is we are asset light. Mm-hmm. Our model is to be asset light. We don't own trucks and trailers. We bring them in as and when we require them. Mm-hmm. So I think we're quite well placed to weather the storm that's coming along. Our warehouses across all the areas are all quite full, and quite full with storage, but obviously activity going through them is dropping. Mm-hmm. As a business, the second half of the year is where we're very, very strong, and we're all hoping that in the next 3 to 6 months the back of this problem will be broken and we get back to sort of some semblance of activity. I have to say, I've been quite encouraged with what's happened in China. And in the first 2 months of the year, one of the areas of our activity that was down was the China imports. And it was only a couple of days ago, one of the COOs in the business told me that we've received an order for 100 containers out of China. So China is definitely getting back to work. And we'll be experiencing more activity coming out of that area and doing clearances for one of our bigger customers. So there's good areas and there's not such good areas. But overall, we are adapting and we are agile enough to adapt. And of course, we've come into the start of this year with what we think is a reasonably strong balance sheet with net cash. And so we're weathering the storm quite well, I believe.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, it's you know what, Steve, it's like you say, you are very flexible, you're asset light, and so you can leverage up or leverage down the fixed cost base pretty much if you want to. And so you've got guidance here still for 2019 to 20% growth. 212 million profit before tax, slightly above 5 million. And yeah, and you've got financial strength. So it's just a case of, you know, weathering the storm a bit, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So, but we're not just stopping there. We carry on. We went to the market 2 years ago with a buy and build program. And so we've had some successes there and some other things we chased, which we didn't quite get. But one advantage with not being able to go out so much is I'm working from home, and we are discussing, as we do all the time, acquisitions. We're getting offered a lot of things. And we're running particularly with two projects at the moment, which we think will be fantastic for the business in terms of slotting in to increasing our capability. So M&A is something which we want to pursue. I would love to do these two deals before the end of the year, and possibly a third one which we're looking at. And there will be opportunities out there that come out of this crisis across various areas.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of opportunities out there in these moments of crisis. And the managers and, of course, the business, they are responding to it.
Yeah. And you know, it's like anything, isn't it, in these kind of times? I think the strong, you know, healthy companies sort of prosper eventually, and the weaker companies, of course, some of them will not survive it. But the strong ones with the good balance sheets and good businesses, diversified, tend to do very well. Okay, Stephen, well, as always, if someone is listening right now, likes the sound of the progress you're making here and where you're positioned, but are not yet following the story, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, we are an asset-light business. And I think at this particular time, if you are agile enough, then there are opportunities. And people should be looking at us not as a short-term in and out. We are a long-term play. And our accounts will, our plans still be out on April 20th. Or late April, and in that we'll outline what I said before, that as a business, in the next 5 years, our ambitions are to get to a turnover of $1 billion, but more importantly, with a good return on the bottom line, and maintaining a progressive dividend policy to shareholders.
Excellent stuff, Stephen. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Okay, thanks.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Majid Shafiq, CEO, and Graham Heath, CFO of i3 Energy. i3e is ticker. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Justin.
Okay, so you released an RNS yesterday, Strategic Production Acquisition and TSX listing, and I've got some questions about that coming up. But as always, guys, could you just, for people not familiar with i3, just give us a brief reminder what the business is about, please.
Okay, Justin, so i3 Energy is an oil and gas company. We're listed on the AIM market in London and have assets in the North Sea. Our North Sea assets contain the Serenity discovery, which we drilled last year. We think that has about 200 million barrels of STOIIP in it. And we also, on our licenses, have the Liberator West and Minos High structures, which we potentially contain even more than that. We are planning to appraise these assets this year with a drilling program, hopefully in the late summer. And we announced yesterday that we'd added a production company based in Canada with a strategy to grow a material production business in the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin.
Yes, well, that announcement, I think, was quite a pleasant surprise to many an investor. So take us through the key sort of takeaways of that acquisition, if you could.
Sure. So, you know, just the what we actually have bought so far, before we go into the, you know, the details of the company itself, we've acquired the senior and junior debt of Tuscana Energy Income Corporation. This is a company that has been around the Western Canadian Basin for some time. They were, you know, one of the many unfortunate companies that bought assets at a much higher price point and also layered in debt at that same time, right? So as, you know, as we've been in this, what is still a lower for longer, since the back end of 2014, they've struggled with their asset package to meet their debt obligations over time. And as things do, as you know, as world prices get worse, that exacerbates the issue. So i3 was basically able to step into the lender's role to Scana by acquiring what was a 24.8 million Canadian dollar senior secured facility and a 3.2 million dollar subordinated facility for $3 million for the senior and $400,000 Canadian for the junior. So some total consideration really of 3.4 million Canadian that we have paid half now, and we'll pay the other half at year end. Alongside that, then we entered into an option agreement with Tuscan itself to acquire 100% of their share capital using i3 shares as consideration. For that, then we've got an option in place that exists up until June 30th, or as extended as otherwise agreed by the parties, wherein we would pay to Tuscana shareholders about 4.4 million i3e shares, so about 4% dilution to current i3 shareholders, and then we would effect basically a merger of the companies through a plan of arrangement, and i3 will end up being a dual listed company with our secondary listing being on the Toronto Stock Exchange on the main board. So we're very excited about it. I'll pass it over to Majid to describe the assets in the company.
Yeah. Thanks, Brad. Yeah, so we've bought a Canadian production business, essentially, at really, really low cost, with low-cost production upside in the current portfolio. And it also contains an asset in the Clearwater play. They have a very large acreage position in this play, which has a really significant upside with materiality similar in scale to what we have in the Serenity asset. A majority of the assets are high working interest and operated. They're a really good operating company, but they also have a really deep knowledge of the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin, the market, and really good M&A skills, which is really important to our strategy going forward. In terms of what we're buying around about 4.7 million barrels of 2P reserves, which produced last year at around about 1,100 barrels of oil equivalent today, and produced field netback of just under $6 million Canadian. And we're paying for that $3.5 million in cash in total and about $500,000 Canadian in shares, which, as Graham said, would be a 4% dilution to current shareholders. So really, really cheap acquisition. The metrics are around about 0.8 dollars per barrel of 2P reserves. These are Canadian dollars, 3,700 per flowing barrel, and 70% of last year's cash flow. So if you look at what assets have traded at recently in the market, not in the current market, but in the very recent market, we would have expected these assets to trade at around about $33,000 per flowing barrel. We're buying them around about $8,000. And at around about $3 per BOE, as I mentioned, we're buying them at $3,700. And they would trade around about $3 per BOE, and we're buying them at less than one. So really, really good acquisition metrics. The portfolio, as I mentioned, has some low-hanging fruit. You know, we could add circa 300 barrels a day based upon some very low-cost activity on some of the wells for around about $2 million. That's from the existing portfolio. We've also got some shut-in gas production of about 500 barrels of oil equivalent per day, which will be opened up to third-party infrastructure once we get that arrangement sorted out. Obviously, production enhancements we will do in the context of the current market for commodity prices, and we'll optimize when we do that work and open up that production based upon where the oil and gas price happens to be. But as I mentioned also, there's huge upside in this Clearwater acreage. And the beauty of it is this is actually, if you look at the metrics of this, it's probably the best new play in the Canadian market at the moment. And it's because it's got a very large resource base, but it's conventional. It's not unconventional, so it doesn't require fracking. The wells are really, it's a relatively shallow reservoir. And the wells are really simple, they're open hole, horizontal multilateral wells. So, for example, you know, the wells cost about $1 million Canadian to drill and complete, and each well could produce circa 200 barrels a day. Toscana has potentially 1 billion barrels of crude on its acreage. The API varies from 13 to 23, so some of it's heavier, some of it isn't. But we would expect the recovery factor to be 5% for natural depletion and up to 10% for secondary with a water flood. So 5 to 10% means that we could have a resource base of 50 to 100 million barrels, which is why I say that it's similar to this in scale to what we have in Serenity. Serenity, we think, could have 100 million barrels of reserves based on a 50% recovery factor. Now, obviously, one of the big differences is the capital intensity. These wells are really low cost and onshore, and we have the ability to bring on wells very quickly to existing infrastructure, in existing third-party infrastructure. The play itself is a relatively new one. It's really over the last 3 years it's begun to be exploited, and during that time, over 150 wells have been drilled in adjoining acreage, and the adjoining acreage is producing about 20,000 barrels a day. So the company itself has an incredible asset base in it. But what we're really buying here is a platform. We're buying the people and the company. And what we want to do is execute on an aggressive M&A strategy to rapidly build a low-cost, long-life, low-decline production base in the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin. And we're going to target assets similar to this, which are relatively low capex. These assets are long-life and mature, so there isn't much capex needing to go into them. But what we want to do ultimately, obviously, is to generate a cash flow base that would allow us to return value to shareholders through dividends and share buybacks.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, decent production, lots of potential there, a good deal. So why were Toscana Energy selling then?
Yeah, so, you know, it's a... This is not a unique example, unfortunately, worldwide across the last, you know, 6 or 7 years. You know, Toscana bought assets, you know, prior to the oil price crash of 14, layered in debt at a similar level. And, you know, if you, there's a lot more risk when you buy assets that are, you know, in a $80 to $100 market than when you're buying assets that are in a $20 market, like today, right? With that then, you know, as time went on in a lower for longer environment, the company just struggled to meet its debt obligations with its senior lenders. You know, where they got themselves into a position by the end of last year with the current assets where they'd, you know, as you do, you tend to sell off your best assets, you know, as funding is required, because those are what will sell into the market. And that simply just exacerbates the issue, right? Because your production goes down, your cash flow gets lower, and so on. With, you know, their enterprise value at the end of 2019, with having, you know, $28.2 million in debt, it basically crushed the equity value down to as low as it could go, which is next to nothing. So that's, you know, circa $30 million of value. And if you look at then the average metrics for both acquisition divestitures and M&A in the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin across 2019, you'll see that the average gas transactions occur at in around $18,000 Canadian per flowing BOE, and for oil assets at about $40,000 Canadian per flowing BOE. So with the gas oil mix of Tiscana, that puts a valuation on this transaction of just over $30 million for their 1,065 BOE per day, which is what they produced across the extent of 2019. So it's, you know, it's basically a $30 million valuation, but 100% of that valuation was consumed within their enterprise value by over-leveraging and a debt load. So, you know, when oil prices crater then, as they have across the last few months, very few parties are making money at these levels. That, you know, gave us the opportunity to go and negotiate with Tiscana's senior and junior lenders to basically take their place by paying what is, you know, 12% of the outstanding balances of the debt in order to take that senior and junior lending position to Tiscana. And with that then comes the opportunity, obviously, then to acquire the company on a 100% basis. Madge and I have been looking across other jurisdictions globally under our loan notes that I3 put in place in May of 2019. We were required to seek out and you know, move into a secondary listing that is HMRC recognized. The Toronto Stock Exchange fits that. It's a, you know, it's a low risk, relatively low risk jurisdiction for us, and, you know, we've seen some systemic issues in that system that we believe will resolve themselves in the near term. You know, we obviously, Canadian crudes all trade at a discount. There's many different blends of Canadian crude. They all trade at one form of discount or another to WTI. But it's important to note that, you know, Tiscana's break even is not far north of $20 a barrel. The main oil blend that they attract is called MSW. It's mixed sweet blend, which is, you know, about a $3 differential to WTI, which means that their asset package is basically, you know, breaking even today. So, you know, the oil markets generally, when you look historically, you know, we've seen a lot more trading well north of 20 than well below 20. And we do expect that things will get back there in time. And with that, this will be a great transaction for us. But more importantly, Tascan is a great platform for us to add additional portfolios and assets on top of what's already a fully functioning corporate and operational organization.
Yeah, yeah. And what sort of decline are you expecting on the production there?
So these are relatively mature assets, Justin, so they have a low decline rate and a long life. So the reserve life index is around about 15 years for the 2P reserve. So that means if we take the 2P reserves that we've bought, 4.7 million barrels, and divide those reserves by projected production for 2020, it would take 15 years to produce out those 2P reserves. So really, very long life reserves. You know, the percentage decline itself doesn't change very much, but the absolute decline obviously starts to decrease, and that's what we have here. And also, you know, some of these assets are on have energy being provided to the assets with water injection, and that's assisting in maintaining the energy and production rates.
Yeah, okay. And you both mentioned, actually, this is the first step of many acquisitions, is it, hopefully?
It is, indeed. Yeah, so, you know, we have been looking at other assets that are available in the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin since really the back end of 2019. You know, the existing portfolio has growth opportunities, so for very low cost, we can probably increase the current production by, you know, 200 to 300 barrels of oil per day and about 500 BOE per day in gas. Obviously, there's no point in doing that right now when you're, you know, when our world oil markets are so poor. We'd just be wasting those hydrocarbons. But for a few million dollars Canadian, we can get those sorts of levels back on stream. We also intend to drill the Clearwater play in the coming winter months. And the Clearwater play, as Majid said, it's currently a, you know, absolute top ranked Canadian play. There's, you know, lots of other majors that are validating that right now by moving into the area. These wells are very cheap. You know, they're $1 million a well. You can do, let's say, 3 to 4 wells per section. And each of those will produce 200 to 300 barrels of oil per day. So that would be, you know, 1,000 to 1,200 barrels of oil per day per section. And Tascana owns 46 net sections. So you could see, you know, very material upside from within the current portfolio. But beyond that, then, you know, especially in times like this where there is lots of distress in the system, we're going to quickly look to act on other potential opportunities where parties either are looking to or need to get off of their current portfolios. And it will allow us to fold those into, you know, a team that already has the capacity to take on, you know, a lot more production within their system. So we've got that foundation in place and we're looking to add to it.
Excellent stuff. Okay, and one final thing. If someone is listening to this, likes the sound of what you're doing there, but are not yet following the story, could you give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please?
Yeah, so I think firstly, we have some significant catalysts this year in the portfolio. Until we announced this deal, the major catalyst was our appraisal drilling program this summer on Serenity. We are still very hopeful that that will happen. But we have added another significant, we hope, drilling catalyst in the Clearwater acreage in Canada, which we also hope to drill later this winter. And as mentioned earlier, that is of a materiality that's similar to Serenity, we believe. Secondly, i3, as of today, is now a production company. So a very different company to the one yesterday, with a different risk portfolio and with the potential to grow that production organically at very low cost from the existing asset base. But very importantly, thirdly, we now have a platform to build a very large production base at really once-in-a-lifetime acquisition metrics if we can get this right. So that could completely change the way that i3 looks if we're able to execute on that strategy.
Majid Graham, thank you very much, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thank you.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman. He's an author. I've got the book here. In fact, my coffee is now sitting on this book. You know, I don't mean to degrade it anyway, but The Crypto Trader. But it's very handy for that, if you've read it and all, you know. But it's a nice thing there. I don't know where my other... I did have a coaster here, but the mister's cleaned the office on the weekend, and I don't know where it's gone. But so I'm temporarily, Glenn, but I can see your face all the time now.
Well, until, I appreciate that you've had my book on your desk for like a year, which is impressive.
Your face is looking at me all the time until I put my cup on top of it a little bit, and there you are on the corner of the book. Anyway, of course, there's lots of good stuff inside. Anything happening this week, Glenn, on the markets and Bitcoin, anything at all relevant, worth talking about?
All right, well, let's start with the markets in general, because, as you know, I trade a lot of stocks, not just the old cryptocurrencies. And this may be irrelevant by the time your podcast goes out, who knows? But I went long. I decided to... I like the charts for a start, right? Yeah. So the pattern the pattern is for about the past sort of couple of weeks, really, the market started slowly forming what we would call a head and shoulders bottom, you know, a sort of classic type of pattern that you get at the bottom of a long trend. Well, not even a long trend in this case, but, you know, a decent, massive downtrend. And it started forming a head and shoulders bottom. By about a week ago, that pattern was starting to become clearer. So I was kind of thinking to myself, it's time to start going long. So because I'd been on the sidelines. Not like permanently long. Sorry, you know, I don't mean to say this is the beginning of the new bull market. Oh, no. I'm talking about a sort of short-term long stance. More than a dead cat bounce, though. And the reason why I decided to go long was because specifically everybody was going on and on about a dead cat bounce, particularly on Twitter and in loads of articles and in the media. You know, this is a dead cat bounce. This is a dead cat bounce. When people think dead cat bounce, they think it's going to be shallow and it's going to be short-lived. And when everybody's saying the same thing about the markets, sure as eggs is eggs, you know that something different will happen. So because everybody was saying it would be a little dead cat bounce, I thought, no, it'd probably be bigger than that. It will surprise everybody. It's now getting to the point, as I say this, where it is starting to surprise everyone. Just the strength and the duration of this rally is starting to surprise people. I doubt it's finished yet, which is why I'm still long. I think it could have another few days left in it yet. That's my best guess, another few days left in it. And it will get to a point where all the shorts, all the people who are short, get scared. They've lost a lot of their profit and they start covering their shorts, which typically will then lead to a massive peak in buying, a sort of little mini buying frenzy. And then that would mark the end of this rally and a return to the kind of downward sloping choppiness that you would expect during a bear market, which is what we are definitely now in.
Yeah. Did you? I guess you didn't look at my video over the weekend, did you?
Oh, should I? Should I have?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. What did it say? What is it called? Dead cat bounce?
No. I go into last previous few bear markets and recessions. In fact, back to the 1928. But I look at the averages and all that, and then look at everything in this recession, all that stuff. And this is going to be a lot worse, I believe, than the financial crisis. I totally agree.
I'm talking short term. I must stress that. I'm talking about a short term bounce.
Yeah, and like I said, in 2002, where the .com was finally collapsed, and 2008, the financial crisis, we saw rallies of 20-21%, you know, off the bottom there, and then, well, we thought it was the bottom. Then it came back down, and it rallied again by 18-20%, and then, of course, big drop down again, about 25% down from there. And and that was about 6 months in to the first drop. And like I said, if you look back, every bear market, that's 21 bear markets since 1928, they, on average, have fallen 36%. We're now at about 20% down. That's all because we've had a rally. They've lasted for 337 days, and that's the average. Now, I believe this to be bit worse than the average, because this is going to affect every sector. If you look at the unemployment in America, historical highs it hit last week. Never ever they had 3.28 million people registered unemployed in a week.
I know. I mean, you see that graph where the unemployment graph where it suddenly just shoots up into practically, it looks like infinity, doesn't it?
No, it's nuts. Well, if judging by that, I mean, you know, the biggest one weekly sign on by Americans was in 1982, and it was 695,000 people. Let me just get the calculator. So divided by 6955000. So pretty much 4.75 times the amount of people registered in 1 week than is the previous biggest high they've ever had. And they're saying, hang on, this is just a start. There's some economists who did a survey, and they hit it nail on the head. They had 3.3 million that were registered unemployed. They see it happen 4.7 million this week. So, but put this in context, of course, the last biggest crash we had was the financial crisis, where everything was going wrong. Apparently, banks were imploding, and ever since the end of capitalism, they had in 2 years unemployment. They had 8.7 million. We're going to do that. We're going to do that probably in 2-3 weeks. So the markets at the moment are rallying. At the moment, if anything, this is a massive bear market rally. You know, and
already
the weak companies are starting to go through. Already, we've seen Carlyle Shoes, we've seen that Bright House. They're starting to go through already because they've got issues. But this exposes the weak companies first. The weak companies just topple over. They can't cope with the lack of revenue, and then you'll start to see, you know, progressively, you'll start to see, you know, other companies start falling over. Some of them will be a lot stronger than those original. But then, it's all about unemployment, because what happens is, and people were talking about this rally, saying it's an excellent rally yesterday, last week, 20% from the Dow.
Well, it's excellent in the sense that, I mean, you know, I know you're a long-term investor, and when it comes to stocks, I usually am as well, but I just couldn't resist, because I could see this rally was going to have such strength. Yeah. I couldn't resist the kind of a shorter-term trade, you know, lasting just a few days or maybe a couple of weeks at most. That's what I had in my head. And so far, I've been long for only a few days, but, you know, I'm making good money out of it. It seemed worth doing to me.
Yeah, no, I'm just sitting on cash waiting for the opportunity. Because obviously it'll come around, but I mean, you know, like I said, 21% rally the Dow. It hasn't done that since 1931, that kind of fast rally. And people thought I was good. And I said, hang on a sec. It hasn't done that since 1931. That's not good. We're talking about volatility here. That kind of volatility didn't happen previously until 1931. So if you look back at 1931, that was the Great Depression. That was 10 years of issues and contracting growth. You know, a quarter of Americans were out of work.
And let's not forget the stock market fell 90% Wall Street did.
Exactly. When you get that level of unemployment, it has it's a tipping point on the economy, because there's less people buy stuff, so, you know, companies lay people off, and then obviously those people can't afford to buy stuff, so companies lay people off. It's just a downward spiral, and it gets to the stage where, and that's why the government's central banks at the moment are throwing so much money at this at the moment, because they realise they can't afford for it to go into a depression. And the figures, the early signs are, with this kind of unemployment, it could happen, and that's really worrying, you know. So that's why they
could do, but then because this is unprecedented. And such a kind of swift and short-term thing, or relatively short-term, so far, then you could argue that once the recovery does get, you know, once people are allowed out of their houses all over the world, there could be, you know, suddenly all this pent-up demand could start being expressed very quickly in the market. Everybody in the world is going to want to go on holiday because they're just all desperate. You know, no, it's like, this is our dream now.
But you can't say that. Hang on.
You know what I mean?
I understand. I want to go on holidays. Definitely. We've cancelled a holiday. We're probably going to miss two.
So, well, people who've never been on holiday, you know, Americans will all be getting passports.
The great metric here is unemployment. If you're unemployed, you're not going to book a holiday. So if you got a lot more people unemployed, you know, there's a lot of people there just not in the market. for a holiday. They can't afford a holiday.
But maybe that's temporary. That's the point, is that
temporary.
I mean, this is a big if, sure, but
the fallout
suddenly
from
takes
recessions.
Off again because everybody starts we all leave our houses, then people could start getting employed. You could see that spike go in the opposite direction.
It's a fantasy world.
3 million people, people could suddenly get jobs.
It's not going to happen, though. How is it going to snap back when all you'll have for the next few weeks, basically, the metrics are these. You'd have deaths increasing in America, pretty much. It's still going up. You'll have unemployment insolvencies. So there'll be more people chasing less jobs. That's all there'll be. So it will get back to it, but it'll take a lot longer. It won't just snap back into position like people think, because there'll be less job places. There'll be less people. There'll be more unemployed. So there'll be less money in the system for people. So
there's plenty of there are a lot of unemployed people, a lot more unemployed.
No, but what I'm saying is, it won't snap back to where it was.
There's also a lot of people with money that they aren't able to spend at the moment. A hell of a lot of people throughout the developed world basically saving up their money at the moment because they've got nothing much to spend it on. A lot of them are still earning wages for not doing very much, sitting at home, and. So that pent-up demand could get expressed very, very quickly and sharply in the markets once they're allowed out their houses, which admittedly might not be for months. It might not be weeks, when it happens, very suddenly.
Hang on. You're not going to suddenly book five holidays. You only book the one you missed out on.
Yeah, but the point is, a lot of people don't, a lot of people who might only, not everybody goes on like three holidays a year. There are a lot of people who never go on holiday for years on end because they're self-employed or they're hard workers or don't forget, hardly any Americans ever leave the country to go on holiday. Only a very small proportion of them do. Dreaming about the idea of, visiting all these countries that they always intended to visit but never got bound to.
Are you making this up? You're making it up.
Yeah, I'm making it up. It's like I'm speculating here.
I know,
about
but why would an average American right now, the economy is depleted and weaker, and there's also worry that that a second wave in the coronavirus is there. Why would they suddenly go travelling? They've never done it ever before in their lives because the economy is taking a battering anyway. If you've seen Wuhan, they're tentatively coming back out from their holes in Wuhan. They're not just rushing out and going on holidays. They're literally still worried. They're still wearing face masks. They're still social distancing. We'll be doing the same thing.
Yeah, that's because they know the rest of China is. That there's still plenty of the virus.
They're lying
in there,
China. They are absolutely lying with their figures. Absolutely lying. How can they, right? So the epicenter was Wuhan. That is a city bigger than London, right? So people were saying, I remember someone said, wait to get over to London. I said, what are you talking about? There are like 20 cities in China bigger than London we've never heard of. Well, with 10 of them anyway. Wuhan's one of them. So it's right in the middle of a very busy, big city. And literally, if you look at the total deaths in order, you got Italy number one with 11,000. You got Spain at 7,000. China at 3,000. Hang on, the most populous city in the world, a populous country in the world, 1.5 billion people. It started there. And you've had less deaths than Spain. And America's about to overtake them. You are lying. And you realize now they lie about their GDP and all that stuff and their PMIs, everything in China.
They lie about harvesting the organs of living people and putting them into party officials who've got heart problems. I mean, they lie about everything. I mean, I don't know if you saw that, the tribunal back in January. It hardly got any coverage because obviously everybody was already terrified about coronavirus, which was hogging the headlines. But there was a very serious tribunal involving some of Britain's leading QCs and the world's leading experts. And they did a proper kind of a proper case where they investigated all the evidence for the Falun Gong prisoners and the Uyghur prisoners in China, whether or not these allegations of organ harvesting were true or not. And they found a huge amount of evidence. They documented enormous amounts of evidence that it has been going on for about 20 years and is still going on a large scale. I mean, these are kind of Nazi scale crimes that we're talking about here. Taking prisoners, giving them all blood tests. I mean, many, many Uyghurs have testified that they're constantly being given blood tests while they're under detention. And then many of them, of course, disappear. Where do they disappear to? Well, there's strong evidence that they're disappearing off to have their organs taken out of them, in many cases while they're still alive. And then their bodies are encased in concrete in order to hide the evidence afterwards.
I mean, it's awful.
It's like you're laughing, and you're laughing because it seems so ridiculous. It's almost like a Hollywood film, and it's actually happening in real life. It's astonishing. This is what the Chinese government is doing all the time, and of course, it completely denies everything.
Have a guess who else has got low figures? Like Russia. It's like, and we can trust them as well, can't we? Russia, like, they've locked down people. They've been only about 10 deaths. Why are these countries lying? It'll help us all. You started in China, Barry. Help us out, because you're killing us now. That virus that started there is killing a lot of people. You should help us out, be transparent, and try and help us, you know, rather than just say, no, we didn't have 3,000 deaths. You did not have 3,000 deaths. It's like a nuclear bomb going off in the middle of a city and said, oh, no, only one person got away with a scrape on their knee. It's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. I discovered, I often report on PMI numbers and all this stuff, and I've just learned something I didn't realise. So they say that China, for example, had a rebound, right? Their PMI above 50 is expansion, they say, in factories and all that stuff, or whatever it is, purchasing management index, and below 50 is in contraction. Now, in February, when everything was shut down in China, right, they had 35.7 was the number. And I thought, well, okay, it doesn't seem as bad as I thought, you know, because 35.7. And then now, in March, 52. So could you think this is a measure against a number? You think it's a standard number, don't you? Which is the activity against that. So each month is independent of one before, but it's not. It's a comparison on the last number. Basically, they ask 3,000 businesses, apparently, and they'll say, how are you doing this month compared to last month? Oh, and in February, this lady actually explained it to me on Twitter. She's, I assume, from China, but she used to do it for her company. So basically, in February, you'll say, oh, it's awful this month compared to last month. So just write down a number, like 35. And then in March, I say, how's it this month compared to last month? Well, it's better than last month, yeah. So compared to last month, even though it's not as good as where it should be, it's showing 52, which everyone thinks, well, that's the standard independent scale, so they're obviously expanding again. No, they're expanding a bit last month, so it means nothing in the grand scheme of things. I've been reporting on these figures for years. I didn't even realise what they meant. And I thought, it's a farce. It's all a farce. And so that's why you can only go by, pretty much, in transparent economies, pretty much the thing to go by is pretty much just unemployment. You know, that's where you can go with it. Because everything else is made up, you know.
Absolutely. I saw, I forget who, but a really excellent economist who I follow. I say a really excellent economist who I follow, whose name I've completely forgotten. But a guy who did some excellent research, basically, on how you can predict, you know, is there any way to use fundamental data to predict when the next stock market downturn will occur. And he found an extremely strong correlation between unemployment figures in America starting to tick up and the beginning of stock market downturns. That is actually a leading indicator and pretty reliable one. So, I mean, obviously in this case, things are ridiculous, out of proportion, everything's crazy right now. But in general, generally speaking, if you keep a good eye on the unemployment figures coming out of America each month, then that gives you a bit of a heads up into the future of the stock market.
But it's a lagging indicator. It's a trouble.
It's a bit of a leading indicator. Unemployment figures are indicator.
If you look at the last couple of recessions, though, it spikes whenever the market's gone down. So it's a bit of a lag. But you can get America.
Yeah, but you have to wait. You just have to look for the beginning of the change in trend in the unemployment.
Well, America,
just when they stop going down and they start going up, even if it's only a tiny bit up, it tends to give you a heads up about stock markets will react badly to that at some point in the near future.
Yeah, well, this is a lot of people saying. I mean, if you look at the Centre for Economic Business Research, they say it's going to be the worst recession this century for the UK, and they see GDP contracting by more than 10%. Our GDP was flat last quarter. That's before the coronavirus. So. Yeah. If it's going to go down 10%, that's really worrying, you know.
That's massive, isn't it? I mean, it will be enormous for us, but I don't know. I mean, as you can tell, I have a certain amount of sympathy for the snapback theory, the idea that
we could
suddenly recover as quickly as we fell. But I'm certainly not banking on that. financially, put it that way.
This is where I agree with you on, right? I'm dying for a holiday. I want to get out and just do something. I'm pretty much a hermit anyway. But even as now, it's almost enforced on me. I just want to get out. I want to be like, what's the name? Judy Andrews in Sound of Music. I want to run the hill. But now I want to go on holidays, but I can't go on 5 holidays and make up for like maybe if you're done for whatever or more. So the company has lost money on that holiday. It's more associated costs with that, and so yeah. I'll probably replace that if it does replace it. If they push the prices up a little bit, that's a good point actually. Maybe it's a book early because now's the time to book.
Now.
Yeah, because there's lots of demand. But I don't think it'll be. It won't last for long. That surge. I mean, the stock market will bounce as well because we'll have some positive news. The lockdown has ended. Yay! Bit of surprise. Everyone goes out for a drink. But then you've got the problem of having a lot less people employed, and then because of that, you'd have less growth. And so that is longer lasting effect. So I think we'll have an initial rally, and then we'll realise. Hang on a sec. This financial crisis is a bit going to drag on for a bit longer than we thought.
I still think those unemployed people could be hoovered up pretty quickly.
Hey, what are you? You working for China, are you? Don't hoover them up. That's a good way of doing it. Any unemployed, just hoover them up. They're just a mess hanging around the place. We'll just hoover them up. And perfect. That's how China deal with things, probably. Just hoover them up. Get rid of them. Yeah, that's it.
As we've only got a few minutes left, I should probably move on to Bitcoin very swiftly. Yeah. Currently, Bitcoin is in a trading range. It's trading. It's going sideways, and it has been doing for about 2 weeks now. There have been a couple of false breakouts where it looked like it was about to take off, and sort of did start taking off, and then quickly went backwards again. So I've had my fingers slightly burnt there a couple of times where I tried to buy those breakouts and then quickly got out with little losses or more or less flat. So I haven't really lost money, but it's frustrating nonetheless. And obviously it's frustrating for a lot of traders in the same position. So now we're in the situation where it's just doing that up and downy, up and down within a little trading range, going sideways. What will the next move be? Looking at the chart on a longer term basis, it's we're in a short-term uptrend within a longer-term downtrend, and that's never a good position to be in. As a chartist, you want to see all the different time frames matching up. You want to see a short-term uptrend within a longer-term uptrend within a grand uptrend. That's the kind of position where if you buy, your risk reward is extremely favorable. Whereas when you're in this kind of situation where you've had a big fall and then the market's kind of creeping its way back up again, it's something that a short-term trader can make a bit of money out of, but as a longer-term trader it gives you pause because you know that this short-term little uptick might be very temporary indeed. It might just lead to another big plunge. So I'm sitting on my hands at the moment. Yeah. As I say, with the stock market, I decided to go long, though obviously I'm ready to close those long share trades and my bet on the S&P 500. I'm ready to close all of that at a moment's notice if I start getting negative signs out of the market. But for Bitcoin, I'm just sitting on my hands. I'm out of crypto altogether until I see signs that things are more positive. And I don't know. I can't. There's nothing in that chart that I like. I've got to say.
No. But listen, I just didn't think. I did a video on the weekend. I understand it to you, Glenn. But I, at the end, I'm quite bullish. Saying I genuinely think it'll be a while. We're not going to have a V-shaped recovery, but I think this will present opportunities you only saw, like going back to the financial crisis, where you can invest in some decent companies that have 10 bagged pretty much more than that in the last 10 years, and you sort of sit there, and now it's that dialing back. It's like a time machine. You already know what companies are very good. Their prices got away from you in the last 10 years, but now they're going back to almost 3 years ago, their prices are. It'll probably go back further than that if we have another fall in the markets. They've got decent customer bases, good supply chains, efficient management, and they're good companies, and so they're growing very well. So just go back to that, invest in those, and just chuck a bit of money in those, and just sit back and relax for a while, because they are good. They're still good companies,
Indeed. And one last thing to mention with regard to Bitcoin is just that there is a huge amount of interest currently from just investors throughout the world in the story of the idea that the dollar might die, might be committing suicide by, you know, all this enormous amount of money printing, the huge amount of stimulus coming out of America. A lot of people are extrapolating from that it will be very bad for the dollar in the longer term, obviously, because it could create massive inflation if they're printing all this money. Could be very bad for the dollar, which in turn could be very good for Bitcoin and, of course, for gold as well. The gold price has already risen a fair bit. At the moment, it's in a bit of a trading range. It could well, you know, have another big boost soon. Bitcoin may well rise along with it because that's built into that same story of harder assets that may benefit from excessive money printing of dollars. Because, of course, Bitcoin, as we know, has very limited supply, as does gold.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous. Glenn, thanks for that, and we'll speak you next week, if we're still here, of course. I don't want to take it lightly. We could be hoovered up by someone. Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, All Active Asset Capital, AAA. All Active Asset Capital, yeah, it's up 23% to 0.69 pence. At two, AA. So one A less. Well, it's a bit more. It's up 5.8% to 17.46 pence. At three, Dev Clever Holdings, up 12.78%. Of course, Chris on the podcast at 3.75 pence. At two, Bidstack. James on the podcast yesterday, up 8.33% to 6.5 pence. And at number one, Cinegin, 67 pence, up 8%. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Savannah Resources, Coronavirus Pandemic Mitigation. At four, Jangada Mines, interim results. At three, 80 Energy, operation update. At two, Predator Oil and Gas, company update. And number one, corporate update from Harvest Minerals. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciate.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.